Blog Talk Radio.
I release all disappointment from my mental, physical, spiritual, and emotional body. 'Cause I know that spirit guides me, and love lives inside me. That's why today I take life as it comes.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to Higher Consciousness. I am so honored, as always, to have this opportunity to connect with you this evening. My name is Professor Jamila Franklin, and I am the host and creator of the show, Higher Consciousness. And I always give background information about who I am. Currently, I teach psychology at colleges. I have a private counseling practice. I am a certified Reiki master and energy medicine practitioner, a certified metaphysician, author, holistic life coach, certified aromatherapist, radio show talk host, and I also just started my YouTube channel. So for those of you who would like to receive additional information, please go to YouTube and put in my name, Professor Jamila, J-A-M-E-L-A, Franklin, and you will get additional information. And I live in the greater Atlanta, Georgia area, more specifically Stone Mountain, Georgia, and I always go over the reason for my developing the show. I wanted to have a forum for discussions about metaphysics, spirituality, holistic psychotherapy, holistic health, holistic nutrition, divine relationships, the law of attraction, divine prosperity, universal laws, and social and cultural and political topics as well. For some of the shows, we have guests who cover these topics and more. Higher Consciousness is a two-hour show that will allow listeners to delve into topics at a higher vibrational level. And the only ground rule is that everyone gives respect when expressing opinions. And this rule automatically raises your vibrational level so that you can receive respect as well. So, without further delay, tonight's topic is the celebration of Black History Month. And yours truly, Professor Jamila Franklin, is the guest. Internet users, if you would like to join in our discussion this evening, please feel free to call 1-818-572-8023 and press 1. Again, the call-in number is 1-818-572-8023 and press 1 to join the discussion. Only one caller at a time will be allowed to discuss the topics. Again, this is Higher Consciousness, and I am Professor Jamila Franklin. And the purpose for the show is to connect with you on a heart-to-heart and soul-to-soul level. This is not a show for intellectual debates. Instead, this show is dedicated to those who truly, truly want to learn and grow spiritually and to heal. Last week, our topic was The Secret Door to Success, by Florence Scovel Shen. For the entire month of January, I had shows that discussed Mrs. Shen's books. She was a phenomenal New Thought minister during the 20s up until 1940. She died in 1940 in New York. So what you call now the Unity Church, she was a member of that group way before it was called the Unity Church, and The Game of Life and How to Play It was her first book. And she had four books, The Game of Life and How to Play It, Your Word is Your Wand, The Power of the Spoken Word, and The Secret Door to Success. And as I mentioned, too, in a couple of shows, she had written another manuscript, and it was found and given to Louise Hay, where Louise Hay bought it, and everyone probably is familiar with Louise Hay. So that manuscript now has been published, and if you would like to have a copy of her, of Florence Goldschen's latest book, you can contact Hay House, H-A-Y House, and you can order it from Hay House. And feel free to do so. I'm going to order my copy soon. Okay, and what I always do for each show is I go over the stats from the previous shows. Last week we had five listens, live listens, which means five people were listening via the computer as the show was being aired. We had six callers. However, in 1 week, we have had 200 downloads, and people are still downloading the show. So that means that 200 people have already downloaded the show. And as I state each week, even if you are not able to listen to the show live, please, please, please listen to the shows after the show has aired, because that's when we pick up most of our listeners. Because it's not convenient for some people to tune in at 7 o'clock, but they are so interested in the different topics that we discuss. So what happens is they listen to the show after it has aired. And I'm so thankful to each and every one of you, to the live listeners, to the ones who call and to listen via phone, and to those of you who listen to the archived shows. Now, the show first debuted, Higher Consciousness first debuted on October 22nd, 2012. Since that wonderful date, we have had 43,686 listens, which includes the live calls. And this is in only 15 months. So we've had 43,686 downloads, and that is just so remarkable. We cannot be experiencing this high level of success if it were not for the listening audience. If you were not participating, referring people to the show, and telling people about the show, we would not have these outstanding numbers. And these numbers reflect people worldwide. It's not just people here in Georgia or people in America, but people worldwide. We thank you. We thank you. We thank you. So, like I said before, each week what I do is I recap the previous week's topic. And last week's topic was The Secret Door to Success by Florence Goldschen. And we discussed the following topics: The Secret Door to Success, Bricks Without Straw, and five of them were wise. What did you expect? The long arm of God. The fork in the road. Crossing your Red Sea. The watchman at the gate. The way of abundance. I shall never want. Look with wonder. Catch up with your good. Rivers in the desert. And the inner meaning of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. We didn't get a chance to cover that one, but we covered all the other topics that I mentioned. If you were not able to listen to the show last week, please, I encourage you to listen to the series that I did on Florence Goldschen, because I think you will be enlightened and very pleased by once you listen to the show. So, each Monday I covered a book. So there are four shows that you can listen to. So please take the opportunity to do so. And then if you have questions, you can feel free to call me. Even though the show has aired, I would be more than happy to discuss the books with you. This is my passion. Because I'm a teacher by profession, and also my natural inclination is to teach. I remember when I was 4 or 5 years old teaching the children in my neighborhood how to read. I was just so fascinated with words and how they appeared on the page. And I'm also very fascinated with the spoken word, because you, as we've talked about in the 4 weeks that I've lectured on Florence's book, her books, you create your reality with your words. And she gave excellent examples in all 4 of her books. So I'm not going to repeat what she has already stated, but I encourage you to find out more about Florence Govershin and to go to the library to look her up and to order some of her books. You will be very, 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 very pleased. And The Game of Life, like I said, is a very popular book. A lot of people just did not know who she was. Okay, so tonight we are discussing celebration of Black History Month and its founder, Dr. Carter G. Woodson. And if you have any questions, comments, or would like to just join in on the discussion, please feel free to call us at 1-818-572-8023 and press 1. Again, the call-in number is 1-818-572-8023 and press 1. Tonight, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go over quite a few luminaries that have made their marks in African-American history as well as in American history. Some of these people you may know and some you may not know. And that's the purpose of Higher Consciousness, to raise your elevation, your vibratory frequency, to the level of learning about things that you may normally not have heard of or pursued. So Higher Consciousness will bring certain topics and people before you so that you can learn more about the rich and diverse history this country has. So what I want to do now is give you some information about the founder of Black History Month, which really started out as a day, then it changed to a week, and now it has become a month. Carter G. Woodson was born in 1875 in New Canton, Virginia, one of the first African Americans to receive a doctorate from Harvard. Woodson dedicated his career to the field of African American history and lobbied extensively to establish Black History Month as a nationwide institution. He also wrote many historical works, including the 1933 book, The Miseducation of the Negro. He died in Washington, D.C. in 1950. So I'm going to give you information about his early life. Carter Godwin Woodson was born on December 19, 1875, in New Canton, Virginia, to Anna Eliza and James Woodson. The first son of 9 children, the young Woodson worked as a sharecropper and a miner to help his family. He began high school in his late teens and proved to be an excellent student, completing a 4-year course of study in less than 2 years. After attending Berea College in Kentucky, Woodson worked for the U.S. government as an education superintendent in the Philippines and undertook more travels before returning to the U.S. Woodson then earned his bachelor's and master's from the University of Chicago and went on to receive a doctorate from Harvard University in 1912, becoming the second African-American to earn a Ph.D. from the prestigious institution. He came after W.E.B. Du Bois. Okay. After finishing his education, Woodson dedicated himself to the field of African-American history. And this was his passion, working to make sure that the subject was taught in medical schools, schools, and studied by scholars. What Carter G. Woodson found out was that the history of African Americans deserve to have the kind of respect and honor as American history. But we were relegated to basically two sentences in the history books, and they both talked about slavery. And that is not the the legacy of African Americans. We did not come over here to have that misinformation really be perpetuated and take off like wildfire. So Woodson decided to refute a lot of those stereotypes, and he wrote The Miseducation of the Negro. So after finishing his education, Woodson dedicated himself to the field of African-American history, working to make sure that the subject was taught in schools and studied by scholars. For his efforts, Woodson is often called the father of black history. Writing Miseducation of the Negro. In 1815, Carter G. Woodson helped found the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, which later became the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, which had the goal of placing African American historical contributions front and center. Now, the next year, he established the Journal of Negro History, a scholarly publication. Woodson also formed the African-American-owned Associated Publishers Press in 1921, and would go on to write more than a dozen books over the years, including A Century of Negro Migration, which was published in 1918, The History of the Negro Church, published in 1921, The Negro in Our History, published in 1922, and The Miseducation of the Negro, published in 1933. Miseducation, with its focus on the Western indoctrination system and African-American self-empowerment, is a particularly noted work and has become regularly course-adopted by college institutions. They've incorporated within their list of courses to teach. In addition to his writing pursuits, Woodson also worked in a number of educational positions, serving as a principal for Washington, D.C.'s Armstrong Manual Training School before working as a college dean at Howard University and the West Virginia Collegiate Institution. So now we're going to discuss how Black History Month was created. Woodson lobbied schools and organizations to participate in a special program to encourage the study of African American history, which began in February 1926 with Negro History Week. So at first it was a day, Negro History Day. Then that expanded to a week, and then it was considered and passed for it to become the month. So we started out with a day, then it became a week, and now it has grown to be a month. So you see a lot of activities during the entire month of February. So when the program expanded, Woodson chose February for the initial week-long celebration, and he chose it because that's the birth month of abolitionist Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. So that's the reason it is in February, because both of those notable people were born in February. So I don't know how many of you know about Shirley Chisholm, but she was such a powerhouse. Petite little lady, but I'm going to give you some information. Born in Brooklyn, New York in 1924, Shirley Chisholm is best known for her work in New York. And she became the first black congresswoman in 1968, representing New York State in the U.S. House of Representatives for 7 terms. Let me repeat this. She was in that position for 7 terms. Some of us get restless after a day. She was there for 7 terms. She went on to run for the 1972 Democratic nomination for the presidency, becoming the first major party African-American candidate to do so. And she was commended for her charisma and for her courage. Throughout her career, Chisholm fought for education opportunities and social justice. Chisholm left Congress in 1983 to teach. She died in Florida in 2005. Okay, this is one of her quotes. "My greatest political asset, which professional politicians fear, is my mouth, out of which comes all kinds of things one shouldn't always discuss for reasons of political expediency." So she was very gifted in terms of getting her point across and as an excellent debater and orator. But when you speak your truth sometimes, there's a small penalty sometimes that you have to pay. So, and she was willing to pay that to help elevate and improve the lives of countless millions of people of African ancestry. Okay? Famed U.S. Congresswoman and lifelong social activist, Shirley Chisholm was born Shirley St. Hill on November 30th, 1924, in a predominantly black neighborhood in Brooklyn. New York, Shirley Chisholm spent part of her childhood in Barbados with her grandmother. After graduating from Brooklyn College in 1946, she began her career as a teacher and went on to earn a master's degree in education, in elementary education, from Columbia University. Chisholm served as director of the Hamilton Madison Child Care Center from 1953 to 1959 and was an educational consultant for New York City's Bureau of Child Welfare from 1959 to 1964. You see her political activism taking root, and she did such an excellent job when she did when she was making speeches in front of people. She was just so eloquent and just so insightful. So we would now go over her political career. In 1968, Shirley Chisholm made history by becoming the United States' first African-American congresswoman, beginning the first of 7 terms in the House of Representatives, in the House Forestry Committee. She shocked many by demanding reassignment. She was placed on the Veterans Affairs Committee, eventually graduating to the Education and Labor Committee. In 1969, Chisholm became one of the founding members of the Congressional Black Caucus. So it's important for you to know her, not only in terms of her accomplishments, but just to know about her passion and her integrity and her sense of purpose. Chisholm went on to make history yet again, becoming the first major party African-American candidate to make a bid for the U.S. presidency when she ran for the Democratic nomination in 1972. So she precedes Jesse Jackson. She precedes President Barack Obama. She was doing these things when some of them were only babies or children. And she was not dismissed. She was taken very seriously because I know I was able to vote that year, and I voted for her. So there were quite a few people who were making a symbolic stand and sending a symbolic lesson out to not only America but to the world. Okay, so a champion of minority education and employment opportunities throughout her tenure in Congress, Chisholm was also a vocal opponent of the U.S. military draft. After leaving Congress in 1983, she taught out at Mount Holyoke College and was popular on the circuit, the lecture circuit. A lot of people, I know, encourage you to look her up on YouTube. Her last name is spelled C-H-I-S-H-O-L-M, Shirley Chisholm. She was a tiny woman, because I saw her, pictures of her in movies of her when I was young. Tiny woman, but so powerful, extremely powerful, and very focused and very eloquent. Now, about her personal life and legacy, Chisholm was married to Conrad Chisholm from 1949 to 1977. She wed Arthur Hardrick Jr. in 1986. She authored two books during her lifetime, On Bought and On Bossed, that was published in 1970, and the second one, The Good Fight, which was published in 1973. Chisholm died on January the 1st, 2005, at the age of 80, in Ormond Beach, near Daytona Beach, Florida. I want people to really look her up because she was just so phenomenal. And because of Shirley Chisholm, we now have women being taken seriously in terms of running for political office. She opened up the gate for that to happen. And this is what someone stated. She was our Moses that opened the Red Sea for us, Robert E. Williams, president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in Flagler County, said of Chisholm in an interview with the Associated Press, January the 2nd, 2005. William Howard Chisholm's longtime campaign treasurer expressed similar sentiments. Anyone that came in contact with her, they had a feeling of careness, because she made you feel like you mattered. Howard said, and they felt that she was very much a part of each individual as she represented her district. Now, the next person that I'm going to discuss is Patricia Roberts Harris. She was also a trailblazer. And some of these women, a lot of you may not have heard of, but I'm giving you their names now, so you can look them up. Patricia Roberts was born on May 31st, 1924, in Mattoon, Illinois. The daughter of a Pullman car waiter, Harris grew up to become the first African-American woman to hold a cabinet post, serve as an ambassador, and head a law school. Harris fought for fair housing and employment practices under the Carter administration as the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Unfortunately, she died of breast cancer in 1985 at the age of 60. They also had a postal stamp made to commemorate all of her achievements. I think the postal stamp was issued about 20 years ago. Patricia Roberts Harris was born on May 31st, 1924, as I stated before, and she grew up to hold all of these wonderful accomplishments. She was raised by her mother after her father left. She excelled at school and won a scholarship to Howard University in 1941. While at Howard University, Harris served as vice chairman of the university's student branch of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. As a part of the organization's civil rights efforts, she participated in a protest against a restaurant that only served whites. Harris graduated from Howard in 1945 with honors. She then continued her education at the University of Chicago, where she studied industrial relations. In the 1950s, Harris worked at Delta Sigma Theta, a national African-American sorority, as a director. Encouraged by William Beasley Harris, her husband, and a lawyer himself, she decided to go to law school. Harris attended George Washington University's National Law Center and graduated in 1960 as the top student in her class. And that university was predominantly Caucasian. After graduating, Harris spent a year with the Department of Justice. Then she returned to Howard University as a lecturer and later a professor. Outside of class, Harris was an activist for many social causes. She was appointed by President John F. Kennedy to co-chair the National Women's Committee for Civil Rights. The committee oversaw approximately 100 women's organizations across the nation. Now, she was also a trailblazer. And we're going to go over the ways in which she was a trailblazer. In 1965, Harris broke new ground for African-American women when she was appointed U.S. Ambassador to Luxembourg by President Lyndon B. Johnson. And she held that position for 2 years and then returned to her teaching at Howard, where she again proved to be a trailblazer. In 1969, she became the dean of the law school there, making her the first African-American woman to do so. She didn't stay in the position long, however. In 1970, Harris became a corporate attorney at a large law firm, and along with her legal work, she served on the boards of such corporations and companies as IBM, Scott Paper Company, and Chase Manhattan Bank, hoping to encourage corporations to help foster social change. Now, Harris left her law practice in 1977 after being selected by President Jimmy Carter for his cabinet as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, making HUD the first cabinet department to be headed by an African-American woman, and Harris the first African-American woman to hold a cabinet position. The road to earning this historical achievement wasn't completely smooth for her, however, because during her confirmation hearings, some thought her years in corporate law made her unable to understand the needs of the people that HUD serves. And Harris proved her critics wrong by calling for increases in assistance to the poor and putting a stop to discriminatory housing and employment practices, causes she had championed for many years previously. And politically, sometimes described as blunt and tough, Harris demanded the best from her staff and herself while serving as secretary. She was an able administrator who reshaped the agency, which was in disarray when she took over the post. Harris worked hard to rebuild urban neighborhoods and to encourage businesses to invest in troubled areas. Encouraged by her success at HUD, Carter later made Harris the secretary of what is now known as Health and Human Services. Harris left the position after Carter lost the 2018 election to Republican Ronald Reagan. She ran for mayor of Washington, but bowed out after losing the Democratic primary to incumbent Marion Barry. She then left politics and returned to teaching and served as a professor at George Washington University Law School until the time of her death. And she died on March 23, 1985, as I mentioned before, of breast cancer. So tonight what I'm doing now is just really going over the remarkable accomplishments of African Americans, some of whom you may know, and some of whom you may not have known, but I encourage you to call in if you have any questions or if you want to share anything about Black History Month or African American History Month with the listening audience. The number is 1-818-572-8023 and press 1. Again, the number is 1-818-572-8023 and press 1. If you would like to contribute anything to the conversation this evening, please, please feel free to do so. So I talked about some exceptional women, Shirley Chisholm, talked about Patricia Harris, and we talked about the father of African-American history, which is Carter G. Woodson. This is a time for people of all races to really, really, really know about the accomplishments of African Americans, because I know for years the only thing that they would have in the history books as related to African Americans was a small section that dealt with slavery. So those of us who were African American, and when I was growing up, there was nothing that highlighted our accomplishments and our contributions to this country, not only to this country, but to the world. So a lot of people who are African American did not know how to empower themselves, because there was nothing out there that reflected the truth of the African American culture. And people didn't really know about the rich legacy that our forefathers had left, not only for African Americans, but for this country. So until Carter G. Woodson and W.E.B. Du Bois began to write about the accomplishments that African Americans had made, not only in this country, but around the world, that's when people started to say, wow, we're not these stereotypes and these racist myths that are out there that are being perpetuated about the culture. And we do more than sing and dance and entertain. And now we're coming full circle, because those are some of the things that people are receiving more acclaim for dancing and singing and entertaining, as opposed to having children be encouraged to go into professions such as medicine and law and politics and other areas. So this is to set the record straight. I wanted to do the show to really set the record straight for everyone, because there are African Americans who have a lot of misinformation, you know, who really don't know the rich history that we have had for generations, even before coming to this country. So I'm just giving different names and having people hear these names so you can pursue careers, hopefully, that you may not have thought about, because you may have thought, okay, African Americans were not involved in notable careers before the 60s and the 70s. No, our history is very, very, very rich and goes all the way back to before coming here to this country. You know, it goes all the way back to the continent of Africa and the different countries on the continent of Africa. So hopefully people who are listening will feel encouraged, regardless of race, to do the research. And one of the notable people that is really, really good about correcting the myths that are out there and dispelling with the racist notions that have been perpetuated is Tim Wise, W-I-S-E, who's Caucasian, and he's a diversity expert. So look him up on YouTube, W-I-S-E. He does a phenomenal job in terms of race relations and setting the record straight. So, and what I've said, too, in the past is sometimes people don't like to talk about race relations because it makes people of all races uncomfortable. And when you say that you want to talk about race, then people start thinking, okay, you want people to be polarized and separate. No, that isn't it. What I compare this to is a cancer or any deadly disease. And racism is a deadly disease of the psyche, of the brain, of the emotions. If you don't address a deadly disease, it tends to then consume you, and it eats you alive, and it eats you up on all levels. So dealing with racial stereotypes, talking about them, and talking about African-American history, Latino history, women's history, all those different groups that have been marginalized, I think it's very important for us to shed light on the accomplishments of the different groups, because people don't have the information, and when you don't have information, you're easily led astray or believe the things that are not true, because you have not had the opportunity to either research it on your own or to know that it's even out there for you to research it on your own. And that's why I bring different topics to Founders Swing audience, because it's to give you more information that you may not have had, or to give you information that you may have had, but you want to get more information about it. And so I provide you with the sources and the background information that you may desire so you can take it further. So another person that I want to discuss, who is really, really, who is just a trailblazer in her own right. I talked about her last year during this time, but I always mention her because so many young people are not familiar with her. Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer was born on October 6, 1917, in Montgomery County, Mississippi. In 1944, she met civil rights activists who encouraged blacks to register to vote and soon became active in helping. Hamer also worked for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was SNCC, which fought racial segregation and injustice in the South. In 1964, she helped develop and establish the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And she died in 1977. One of her famous quotes, "One day I know the struggle will change. There's got to be a change, not only for Mississippi, not only for the people in the United States, but people all over the world." During her early life, civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer was born Fannie Lou Townsend on October 6, 1917, in Montgomery County, Mississippi. She was the youngest of 20. That's correct. She was the youngest of 20 children. Her parents were sharecroppers in the Mississippi Delta, and Hamer began working in the fields when she was only 6 years old. Around the age of 12, Hamer dropped out of school in order to work full-time and help out her family. She continued to be a sharecropper after her 1944 marriage to Perry Papp Hamer. The couple worked on a cotton plantation near Ruleville, Mississippi. They were unable to have children after Hamer had a surgery to remove a tumor. During the operation, her surgeon gave Hamer a hysterectomy without her consent. This used to happen a lot to black women. They would go in for routine checks, and they were told that they would have diseases, that they had diseases that they did not have, and they were given hysterectomies, and they were made sterile, as a matter of fact. This was not uncommon. In the summer of 1962, Hamer made a life-changing decision to attend a protest meeting. She met civil rights activists there who were there to encourage African Americans to register to vote. And Hamer was one of a small group of African Americans in her area who decided to register themselves. And on August 31st, 1962, she traveled with 17 others to the county courthouse in Indianola, Mississippi, to accomplish this goal. They encountered opposition from local and state law enforcement along the way. Such bravery came at a high price for Hamer. She was fired from her job and driven from the plantation she had called home for nearly two decades, just for registering to vote. But these actions only solidified Hamer's resolve to help other African Americans get the right to vote. According to the New York Times, she said, "They kicked me off the plantation. They set me free. It's the best thing that could have happened. Now I can work for my people." Hamer decided to dedicate her life for the fight for civil rights, working for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. This organization was comprised mostly of African-American students who engaged in acts of civil disobedience to fight racial segregation and injustice in the South. Now, these acts often were met with violent responses by angry whites. During the course of her activist career, Hamer was threatened, arrested, beaten, and shot at. She was severely injured in 1963 in a Winona, Mississippi jail. She and two other activists were taken in by police after attending a training workshop. Hamer was beaten so badly that she suffered permanent kidney damage. In 1964, Hamer helped found the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which was established in opposition to her state's all-white delegation that year for the Democratic Convention. She brought the civil rights struggle in Mississippi to the attention of the entire nation during a televised session at the convention. The following year, Hamer ran for Congress in Mississippi, but was unsuccessful in her bid. And along with her political activism, Hamer worked to help the poor and families in need in Mississippi. She also set up an organization to increase business opportunities for the underserved and to provide child care and other family services. She helped establish the National Women's Political Caucus in 1971. In 1976, Hamer was diagnosed with breast cancer. She continued to fight for civil rights despite her illness. She died on March 14, 1977, in a hospital in Mound Bayou, Mississippi. Hundreds crowded into a Ruleville church to say goodbye to this tireless champion for racial equality. Andrew Young Jr., then a U.S. delegate to the United Nations, gave the eulogy of Hamer's at Hamer's funeral. He explained, "None of us would be where we are today had she not been here then," according to the New York Times. Young said that the progress of the civil rights movement had been made through the sweat and blood of activists like Hamer. On her tombstone is written one of her most famous quotes, "I am sick and tired of being sick and tired." So for those of you who would like to know more about Fannie Lou Hamer, her last name is spelled H-A-M-E-R, first name F-A-N-N-I-E, Lou, L-O-U, and again her last name, H-A-M-E-R. And if you have any questions or any comments, please feel free to call 1-818-572-8023 and press 1. Again, feel free to call 1-818-572-8023 and press 1. Now, the next person that I want to discuss and who is really, really controversial, and Spike Lee made a movie about him, is Malcolm X. And most of the information into the past 20 years was so incorrect about his life. So now there's more accurate information about who he was, because a lot of people felt that he was anti-white and that he hated white people and that he was just extremely, extremely militant, none of which was really true. But that's what I had mentioned earlier in terms of how myths get started and how they polarize people and they keep people from digging deeper for themselves to find out for themselves exactly what really happened about people who are marginalized. So women, African Americans, Latinos, Asians, Native Americans, people who have different sexual preferences have been largely marginalized. And it's time for us to really set aside those differences and to see people as energetic beings. But we can't do that until we really address these internal prejudices that you may have I'm not a person who tells people to get over it. I tell people to go through it. So in order for you to love, honor, and respect others, you have to love, honor, and respect yourself first. And then after that, you have to love, honor, and respect other people's legacies and histories and experiences. Because, like I said, in this country, people do not like to talk about race. They want to push it to the side. And pushing it to the side has not healed any of the racial wounds. The only way we can do that is talk about the history of what has happened and then come up with a commitment, have a commitment that we're going to start healing our personal wounds, our internal wounds, and then once we do that, then we can come together as a collective to heal the racial divide and the wound that has been present within this country since the founding of this country. So, and I'm so very optimistic and hopeful because I see young people who are committed to doing that, and I see things happening and changing. However, the history of those people, African Americans and Asians, Latinos and Native Americans and women and people of different sexual orientations, those histories have to be highlighted and have to be told in order for people to be able to love, to honor, and to respect others. Because you cannot love people, you can't really love them completely and wholly if you don't know who they are. And you can't really love you completely and wholly if you don't know who you are. So this show tonight is to have us begin the discussions. Hopefully people will talk about the topics that I'm going over tonight, have group discussions, have people of different ages, different races, different ethnicities and orientations sit down and have a dialogue and discussion about these things, because that's the way that you begin to heal, when you open up and discuss and talk about things that make you feel uncomfortable, okay? Because then what you do is you shine the light on it, and so then you can see that most of the things were myths or distorted pieces of information about others. So we're going to change that, right? Now, born on May 19, 1925, in Omaha, Nebraska, Malcolm X was a prominent black nationalist leader who served as a spokesman for the Nation of Islam during the 1950s and 60s. Due largely to his efforts, the Nation of Islam grew from a mere 400 members at the time he was released from prison in 1952 to 40,000 members by 1960. Articulate, passionate, and a naturally gifted and inspirational orator, Malcolm X exhorted blacks to cast off the shackles of racism by any means necessary. And one of his quotes is, "Power in defense of freedom is greater than power in behalf of tyranny and oppression, because power, real power, comes from our conviction, which produces action, uncompromising action." The fiery civil rights leader was well known when he was assassinated in 1965, and I'm going to go over that a little later. Malcolm X was born Malcolm Little on May 19, 1925, in Omaha, Nebraska, and Malcolm was the fourth of eight children born to Louise, a homemaker, and Earl Little, a preacher, who was also an active member of the local chapter of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, an avid supporter of black nationalist leader Marcus Garvey, whom I'm going to discuss a little later. Due to Earl Little's civil rights activism, the family faced frequent harassment from white supremacist groups such as the Ku Klux Klan and one of his splinter factions, the Black Legion. In fact, Malcolm X had his first encounter with racism before he was even born. When my mother was pregnant with me, she told me later, a group of hooded Ku Klux Klan riders galloped up to our home. Malcolm later remembered, brandishing their shotguns and rifles, they shouted for my father to come out. The harassment continued. When Malcolm X was 4 years old, local Klan members smashed all of the family's windows, causing Earl Little to decide to move the family from Omaha to East Lansing, Michigan. However, the racism the family encountered in East Lansing proved even greater than in Omaha. Shortly after the Littles moved in 1929, a racist mob set their house on fire, and the town's all-white emergency responders refused to do anything. The white, quote from Malcolm, the white police and firemen came and stood around watching as the house burned to the ground, end quote, Malcolm X later remembered. 2 years later, in 1931, things got much, much worse. Earl Little's dead body was discovered laid out on the municipal streetcar tracks. Although Malcolm X's father was very likely murdered by white supremacists from whom he had received frequent death threats, the police officially ruled his death a suicide, thereby voiding the large life insurance policy he had purchased in order to provide for his family in the event of his death. Malcolm X's mother never recovered from the shock and grief of her husband's death. In 1937, she was committed to a mental institution, and Malcolm X left home to live with family and friends. Malcolm attended West Junior High School, where he was the school's only black student. He excelled academically and was well-liked by his classmates, who elected him class president. However, he later said that he felt that his classmates treated him more like the class pet than a human being. The turning point in Malcolm X's childhood came in 1939 when his English teacher asked him what he wanted to be when he grew up, and he answered that he wanted to be a lawyer. His teacher responded, quote, one of life's first needs is for us to be realistic. You need to think of something you can be. Why don't you plan on carpentry? End quote. Having thus been told in no uncertain terms that there was no point in a black child pursuing education, Malcolm X dropped out of school the following year. And after quitting school, Malcolm X moved to Boston to live with his older half-sister, Ella, about whom he later recalled, she was the first really proud black woman I had ever seen in my life. She was plainly proud of her very dark skin. This was unheard of among Negroes in those days. End quote. Ella landed Malcolm a job shining shoes at the Roseland Ballroom. However, out on his own on the streets of Boston, Malcolm X became acquainted with the city's criminal underground, soon turning to selling drugs. He got another job as kitchen help on the Yankee Clipper train between New York and Boston and fell further into a life of crime and drugs. Sporting flamboyant pinstriped zoot suits, he frequently went to nightclubs and dance halls and turned more fully to crime to finance his lavish lifestyle. This phase of Malcolm X's life came to a screeching halt in 1946 when he was arrested on charges of larceny and sentenced to 10 years in jail. So while in jail, this is when he really became more political and found out who he was. Sometimes you have to be made to be still because we're doing so much running because we're running away from the pain and we're running away from things that we don't want to see or choose to ignore. So to pass the time during his incarceration, Malcolm X read constantly, devouring books from the prison library in an attempt to make up for the years of education he had missed by dropping out of high school. And I just want to have you note, Malcolm X memorized the entire dictionary from A to Z. I tried that several times when I was a child. Once I read that he had done that, and I could barely get off the first page with the A's. So that is an incredible feat, to memorize the entire dictionary. It's remarkable. Also, while in prison, he was visited by several siblings who had joined the Nation of Islam, a small set of black Muslims who embraced the ideology of black nationalism, the idea that in order to secure freedom, justice, and equality, black Americans need to establish their own state entirely separate from white Americans. Malcolm X converted to the Nation of Islam while in prison, and upon his release in 1952, he abandoned his surname, Little, which he considered a relic of slavery, in favor of the surname X, a tribute to the unknown name of his African ancestors. And now a free man, Malcolm X traveled to Detroit, Michigan, where he worked with the leader in the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad, to expand the movement's following among black Americans nationwide. Malcolm X became the minister of Temple No. 7 in Harlem and Temple No. 11 in Boston, while also founding new temples in Hartford and Philadelphia. And in 1960, he established a national newspaper, Muhammad Speaks, in order to further promote the message of the Nation of Islam. Articulate, passionate, and naturally gifted, and an inspirational orator, Malcolm X exhorted blacks to cast off the shackles of racism by any means necessary. You don't have a peaceful revolution, he said. You don't have a turn-the-cheek revolution. There's no such thing as a nonviolent revolution. Such militant proposals, a violent revolution to establish an independent black nation, won Malcolm X large numbers of followers, as well as many fierce critics. Due primarily to the efforts of Malcolm X, the Nation of Islam, like I stated before, grew from a mere 400 to 40,000 members by 1960. By the early 1960s, Malcolm X had emerged as a leading voice of a radicalized wing of the civil rights movement, presenting an alternative to Dr. Martin Luther King's vision of a racially integrated society achieved by peaceful means. Dr. King was highly critical of what he viewed as Malcolm X's destructive orations. Quote, "I feel that Malcolm has done himself and our people a great disservice," King once said. Philosophical differences with King were one thing. A rupture with Elijah Muhammad proved much more traumatic. In 1963, Malcolm X became deeply disillusioned when he learned that his hero and mentor, Elijah Muhammad, had violated many of his own teachings, most flagrantly by carrying on many extramarital affairs. Muhammad had, in fact, fathered several children out of wedlock. Malcolm's feelings of betrayal, combined with Muhammad's anger over Malcolm's insensitive comments regarding the assassination of John F. Kennedy, led Malcolm X to lead the Nation of Islam in 1964. And now in that same year, Malcolm embarked on an extended trip through North Africa and the Middle East. And this journey proved to be a political and spiritual turning point in his life. And he learned to place the American civil rights movement within the context of a global anti-colonial struggle, embracing socialism and Pan-Africanism. And Malcolm X also made the Hajj, which is the traditional Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca, Saudi Arabia, during which time he converted to traditional Islam, and again changed his name. And this time he changed his name to El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. And after his epiphany at Mecca, Malcolm X returned to the United States less angry and more optimistic about the prospects of peaceful resolution to America's race problems. Quote, "The true brotherhood I had seen during Mecca had influenced me to recognize that anger can blind human vision," end quote. Quote, "America is the first country that can actually have a bloodless revolution," end quote. Tragically, just as Malcolm appears to be embarking on an ideological transformation with the potential to dramatically change his life, he was killed. On the eve of February 21, 1965, at the Audubon Ballroom in Manhattan, where Malcolm was about to deliver a speech, three gunmen rushed the stage and shot him 15 times at point-blank range. Malcolm X was pronounced dead on arrival at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital shortly thereafter. He was only 39 years old. The three men convicted of the assassination of Malcolm X were all members of the Nation of Islam. Thomas Hare, Norman 3X Butler, and Thomas 15X Johnson. In the immediate aftermath of Malcolm X's death, commentators largely ignored his recent spiritual and political transformation and criticized him as a violent rabble-rouser. However, Malcolm X's legacy as a civil rights hero was cemented by the posthumous publication in 1965 of The Autobiography of Malcolm X, as told to Alex Haley. It was a harrowing chronicle of American racism, an unsparing self-criticism, and an inspiring spiritual journey. The book, transcribed by the acclaimed writer of Roots, instantly recasts Malcolm X as one of the great political and spiritual leaders of all modern times. Named by Time magazine one of the 10 most required reading nonfiction books of all time, The Autobiography of Malcolm X has truly enshrined Malcolm X as a hero to subsequent generations of radicals and activists. Perhaps Malcolm X's greatest contribution to society was underscoring the value of a truly free populace by demonstrating the great lengths to which human beings will go to secure their freedom. And in his personal life, in 1958, Malcolm X married Betty Sanders, a fellow member of the Nation of Islam. The couple has 6 children, all daughters: Atala, born in 1958, Kubila, born in 1960, Elitza, born in 1963, Camila, born in 1964, and the twins Malak and Malika, born in 1965. Sanders later became known as Betty Shabazz, and she became a prominent civil rights and human rights activist in her own right in the aftermath of her husband's death. In May 2013, Malcolm X's grandson, Malcolm Shabazz, son of the civil rights leader's second daughter with wife Betty Shabazz, Kubila Shabazz, was beaten to death in Mexico City near the Plaza Garibaldi. He was 28 years old, and according to a report by the Los Angeles Times, police believe that Malcolm Shabazz's death was the result of a robbery gone wrong. So, as I stated before, I'm giving you the history that you may have known or may not have known regarding the African-American experience. And we will come back after this brief commercial break.
This is Professor Jamila Franklin, CEO and President of Oyende Enterprises, a holistic wellness company. We provide dynamic certified Reiki and energy medicine classes and trainings, certified aromatherapy courses, metaphysics courses, life coaching sessions, and private holistic counseling sessions. For more information, call 770-808-8051 or go to our website at www.oyendeenterprises.com. That is spelled O-Y-I-N-D-E www.enterprises.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to Higher Consciousness. This is our show this evening to commemorate those icons that have gone before us and in commemorating their wonderful accomplishments and achievements, not only for people of African ancestry, but for people throughout the world, because we are basically one people. So the whole thing is to expose all of the wonderful things that African Americans have done, not only for this country, but for other countries as well. And once you put the truth out, then the isms lead: racism, sexism, homophobiaism, ageism. Those things leave because then people have accurate information. But as long as people can see themselves as different than or better than or greater than someone else and be judgmental, then you will have the isms. But knowledge really eliminates a lot of the issues that are out there due to inaccurate information. So the more knowledge people have, the less they tend to be drawn into those little sects where they're hating people because they think people are different than they. Because at the end of the day, we have more in common than we have in terms of differences. And with the human genome study, it showed that 99.9% of the people share the same genes. And that's another story that I will talk about. But I just want us to, for once, to have open discussions and dialogues about race, about class, about ageism, about all of these things, because once we talk about them, then we can really dispel with the inaccurate information. Because as long as you're holding on to something that's not true and you're not giving it a voice, you're not expressing it, then people can't tell you the truth about it because they don't even know that you're harboring those feelings or those thoughts. So the way in which to heal is to give air to, shed light upon, and to give voice to the things that you have in your head that's blocking you from having a true and full conversation with someone who looks different, who may look different than you, sound different than you, walk differently than you. But once you talk with the person and you see that the person is an extension of you, really, because we're all connected in the human family, then those prejudices tend to fall along the wayside. But we cannot have them fall along the wayside if we just keep getting over it and not going through it and having the healthy discussions that we need to have, not only about race, but about everything. We need to sit down and have discussions so we can go to the next level. So I had mentioned someone earlier that Malcolm X's father was very much connected to, and that was Marcus Garvey. And Marcus Garvey led one of the first Pan-Africanist movements here in this country. So, I can give you information about Mr. Garvey. Born in Jamaica, Marcus Garvey was an orator for the Black Nationalism and Pan-Africanism movements, to which end he founded the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League. Garvey advanced a Pan-African philosophy, which inspired a global mass movement known as Garveyism. Garveyism would eventually inspire others, from the Nation of Islam to the Rastafari movement. One quote from Marcus Garvey, quote, "Hungry men have no respect for law, authority, or human life," end quote. Social activist Marcus Mosiah Garvey Jr. was born on August 17, 1887, in St. Anne's Bay, Jamaica. Self-educated, Garvey founded the Universal Negro Improvement Association, dedicated to promoting African Americans and resettlement in Africa. In the United States, he launched several businesses to promote a separate black nation. After he was convicted of mail fraud and deported back to Jamaica, he continued his work for black repatriation to Africa. Marcus Messiah Garvey was the last of 11 children born to Marcus Garvey Sr. and Sarah Jane Richards. His father was a stonemason and his mother a domestic worker and farmer. Garvey Sr. was a great influence on Marcus, who once described him as, quote, severe, firm, determined, bold, and strong, refusing to yield even to superior forces if he believed he was right, end quote. His father was known to have a large library where young Garvey learned to read. At age 14, Marcus became a printer's apprentice. In 1903, he traveled to Kingston, Jamaica, and soon became involved in union activities. And in 1907, he took part in an unsuccessful printer's strike, and the experience kindled in him a passion for political activism. So 3 years later, he traveled throughout Central America, working as a newspaper editor and writing about the exploitation of migrant workers in the plantations. He later traveled to London, where he attended Birkbeck College, which is now the University of London, and worked for the African Times and Orient Review, which advocated pan-African nationalism. Inspired by these experiences, Marcus Garvey returned to Jamaica in 1912 and founded the Universal Negro Improvement Association, UNIA, with the goal of uniting all of African diaspora to establish a country and absolute government of their own. After corresponding with Booker T. Washington, the American educator who founded Tuskegee Institute, Garvey traveled to the United States in 1916 to raise funds for a similar venture in Jamaica. He settled in New York City and formed a UNIA chapter in Harlem to promote a separatist philosophy of social, political, and economic freedom for blacks. In 1918, Garvey began publishing the widely distributed newspaper, Negro World, to convey his message. In 1919, Garvey and UNA had launched the Black Star Line, a shipping company that would establish trade and commerce between Africans in America, the Caribbean, South and Central America, Canada, and Africa. And at the same time, Garvey started the Negroes Factories Association, a series of companies that would manufacture marketable commodities in every big industrial center in the Western Hemisphere in Africa. In August 1920, UNIA claimed 4 million members and held its first international convention at Madison Square Garden in New York City. Before a crowd of 25,000 people from all over the world, Marcus Garvey spoke of having pride in African history and culture. Many found his words inspiring, but not all. Some established black leaders found his separatist philosophy ill-conceived. W.E.B. Du Bois, a prominent black leader and officer of the NAACP, called Garvey the most dangerous enemy of the Negro race in America. Garvey felt Du Bois was an agent of the white elite. In 1922, Marcus Garvey and three other UNIA officials were charged with mail fraud involving the Black Star Line. The trial records indicate several improprieties occurred in the prosecution of the case. It didn't help that the shipping line's books contained many accounting irregularities. So on June 23, 1923, Garvey was convicted and sentenced to prison for 5 years. Claiming to be a victim of a politically motivated miscarriage of justice, Garvey appealed his conviction but was denied. In 1927, he was released from prison and deported to Jamaica. Garvey continued his political activism and the work of UNIA in Jamaica and then moved to London in 1935. But he did not command the same influence he had earlier. Perhaps in desperation or more in delusion, Garvey collaborated with outspoken segregationist and white supremacist, Senator Theodore Bilbo of Mississippi, to promote a reparation scam. The Greater Liberia Act of 1939 would deport 12 million African Americans to Liberia at federal expense to relieve unemployment. The act failed in Congress, and Garvey lost even more support among the black population. Garvey died in London in 1940 after several strokes. Due to travel restriction during World War II, his body was interred in London. In 1964, his remains were exhumed and taken to Jamaica, where the government proclaimed him Jamaica's first national hero and reinterred him at a shrine in the National Heroes Park. But his memory and influence remain. His message of pride and dignity inspired many in the early days of the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s. In tribute to his many contributions, Garvey's bust has been displayed in the Organization of American States Hall of Heroes in Washington, D.C. The country of Ghana has named its shipping line the Black Star Line and its national soccer team the Black Stars in honor of Garvey. So we have had several dignitaries, and I call them dignitaries because they are just that, discussed tonight. Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, Fannie Lou Hamer, Shirley Chisholm, Patricia Roberts Harris, and the founder of African American or Black History Week and Month, Dr. Carter G. Woodson. And I'm just so proud of these iconic figures, and I'm so proud that they were able to walk this planet to help all of us of all races to understand and to know who we are. Because a lot of times what happens is that, as I stated before, we have a lot of misinformation, and we use that information to be the gospel truth. And people of all races, African Americans, Caucasians, Native Americans, Asians, Latinos, we use that information, and we use that to incorrectly define who we are because we don't see any counter messages. And now in the age of technology with YouTube and the internet, you can go online and look up all of the people whose names I've given you. Not only can you look them up, but you can see what they looked like. You can find out more about them. And that's wonderful because 20 to 30 years ago, the information was hidden and was more difficult to find out the truth. It was hidden behind the Ivy walls of some of the universities. And if you didn't go to the universities, if you didn't attend the universities, there was no way for you to find out the truth unless you knew someone who has studied African-American history. So a lot of people have had a lot of incorrect information passed down to them. So now with tonight's show, what I wanted to do was to elucidate those people and those ideas that have been really positive and have us have the discussions. As I mentioned before, I think everyone in this country in a position of power, be it a teacher, a lawyer, a state legislator, a minister, someone in the clergy, anyone who has a position or a platform or a podium, I think it's incumbent, and even if a person does not, all of us need to basically sit down and talk to each other, people who look like us, people who don't look like us, to open up and have these much-needed dialogues and discussions, because that's how you heal any kind of trauma, karma, or drama. You heal it by not backing down to it. So racism needs to be confronted head-on, not in terms of having people making disparaging comments to people, but just in terms of just having honest dialogues rather than having people berating people, yelling and screaming like Bill O'Reilly does. That's you can never have a healing when people are berating people and yelling and screaming. And all of that, too, is for television. It makes good, it makes really bad television, but they think that that will spike the ratings, so they have someone like him on giving a lot of inaccurate information. But if, once we decide to open up, and, I've said in other instances that Black History Month is a door opener. During the month of February, even though African Americans have done things before February and throughout the year, they have set aside February, like I said, with Carter G. Woodson, because Abraham Lincoln was born in February, and so was Frederick Douglass. And during the time of Carter G. Woodson, he thought that Abraham Lincoln had very benevolent ideas towards African Americans. It was completely the opposite. Lincoln has stated that if he had any other way to free the slaves, I mean to save the Union other than freeing the slaves, he would do so. So, but that was the sentiment of the times. And so Carter G. Woodson thought he was a champion of freeing Black people, but it was later discovered and found out through his papers that that was not the case. So we need to sit down and have discussions, because people made statements back hundreds of years ago because that was the sentiment of the time, and to view it in that context, but also to see people as people and to understand why they did what they did, so we can move on and start learning how to love, honor, and respect everyone regardless of quote-unquote race, ethnicity, age, or political or sexual orientation. And race is also a social construct. There's no such thing as different races. You know, like I said before, that's going to be another show. But for convenience, people have come up with these terms because people look differently, so everyone thinks that there are these different races, when in fact everyone came from the Nile, the continent of Africa. They've even discovered the Leakeys, who were British archaeologists back, I think, during the 30s and 40s, discovered the first bone on the continent of Africa, in East Africa. And since then, they've discovered bones that even predate that one, and they all have been on the continent of Africa. So all academics and archaeologists understand and know that life began on the continent of Africa. It's not even something that is debated among academics, because it's been proven. And as people left the continent of Africa, you migrate away from a particular area. Over generations, you tend to mutate. So as people moved to colder climates, there was no need for the hair to be tightly curled. It became flat to protect the skull from the cold. And the more you move away from the equator and from the sun, the skin tends to get lighter. So I encourage people to look all this up. Everything that I'm saying, I encourage you to look it up, because you will find a lot of information. I like to plant seeds and spark conversations and spark interest, because once people begin to investigate, then you can be in charge of your life. You don't have to take on recycled information from someone else. You don't have to believe your parents' thoughts. You don't have to believe your teacher's thoughts. You don't have to believe your rabbi's thoughts, your minister's thoughts, your babalawo's thoughts. Once you start taking charge of your life, then you start believing your own and knowing what is true. You start, we then start, like I said, recycling old information. We then, through our research, are able to develop our own truths. So with this month, I am so excited because this time, rather than what I did last time, I went over the history. But now I'm saying that we need to use the history, Black History Month, as a platform to elevate us, to have a different kind of discussion, so we can have a different kind of reality, so we can really walk up to the lion of polarization, the lion of racism, the lion of disparate treatment, and stare it down and say to it that it's no longer going to control us. And we have the power to do that. We have so much power, and we can change any of our thoughts, which will give us a different kind of outcome. So after we come back from this commercial break, I will go.
Are you stressed, tired, need to relax? Peace Be Still, a natural holistic aromatherapy blend, is your answer. My name is Jacqueline Scott, and I have been a faithful user for years. For more information and to purchase Peace Be Still, a wonderful blend for the entire family, go to Amazon.com or call 770-808-8051 today.
Welcome back to Higher Consciousness. This is the first of our shows for the month of February. In the first show, we're starting off with Black History Month. And I have given a lot of history about some notable figures within the African-American community. And for this show this evening, I thought that it was really, really important for people to know about people that they may have heard in passing or may not have heard about, because people are familiar with Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Dr. King. They're familiar with a lot of the figures out there that you keep reading about over and over again, but I'm not sure how many people remember or know about Fannie Lou Hamer, about Patricia Roberts Harris, about know the full history of Marcus Garvey. So in doing this, having this show, I'm giving you more information, because regardless of your race, this is your history. This is not only African-American History Month. It is American History Month. These people made wonderful contributions to the mosaic fabric of this country. So we are going to grow as we acknowledge people who look different than us and sound different than us and honor, love, and respect them. That's how we grow, when we become less ethnocentric and more inclusive. That's how we grow, when we become really committed to social change, to releasing and transmuting all racial and other disparities. That's how we grow. But by running away and not talking about race and saying, well, I love everyone, that is not good enough, because that will continue to create the Trayvon Martin cases and the racial profiling in the Northeast as well as here, because people are doing that because they don't love, value, and respect people who don't look like themselves. And they don't do that because they don't see them as being the same as they. Why? Because the information that they've read and they've kept circulating within their brains confirm that belief that people who did not look like them or talk like them or act like them, those people were different and those people had the issues. Whereas when you start talking to people, even if you want to have a stereotype in your head, you start seeing how many things you have in common and how few things you have that are different, because the person is no longer a number. The person is no longer a racial caricature. The person is no longer a statistic. That person is a real person, because the person is sitting next to you and lives in your neighborhood, and you're putting a face on this thing called race, because you start seeing your neighbors in a different light, because you're listening not only with your head and your ears, but you're listening with your heart. You're becoming more empathic. So that's the reason why I thought that it was really, really important to have the show to discuss these important topics, even if it makes people feel uncomfortable. I love that. It's just like when you have people who have shoes that are too small. They like the shoe because the shoe, I use the shoe analogy a lot. They like the shoe because it was a really beautiful shoe. They fell in love with the style, and they didn't want to change. But the shoe, it's no longer practical because the person's feet have now outgrown the shoe. But rather than getting a new pair of shoes, the person is trying to squeeze his or her feet into shoes that are too small and blaming the shoe. So the comparison is, when we are in situations that make us uncomfortable, rather than running from them, stand there, they're making us uncomfortable to know, like the feet, that we have grown out of that situation of negative thinking, of narrow thinking, of racist thinking. We've gone out of that. And racism, let me explain this too, because this is what I talk to my students about. Racism is not just based on race. Racism is a very diabolical perspective that is based on race and economics. So, and I've had this discussion with a lot of people. So in this country, because African Americans do not control the financial resources, even though we have an African American president, they cannot be racist. And whenever I tell people this, they get so disturbed. African Americans cannot be racist because African Americans are not in control of the financial district. Caucasian males are still in control of the financial district. Now, African Americans can discriminate, they can be biased, and they can be prejudiced. But because they don't control the financial resources and don't control Wall Street, it's not possible. Because racism means that you are excluding a group of people based on race. So you're excluding them from economic resources based on race. So one of my students asked, well, what about he was Caucasian, if I work for a boss who's African-American, or I'm trying to get a job and he doesn't hire me, and that's excluding me from resources. I said, yeah, that is, but that's in a limited level. He doesn't have control over the larger picture, the larger reservoir of resources. He only has control over his job, so he's being prejudiced, he's discriminating, and he's being biased. But racism is based on excluding people who don't look like people, and people who have resources, excluding people who are African-American, Latino, and Asian, or women, or whatever, from housing, solely based on race, not based on anything else. Excluding people from jobs based on race. So you're excluding them from financial resources because you have the power to do so. Now, if we were in another country, like an all-black country, where the people who are African-American, or not African-American, but people who are of African ancestry, had control over the resources, you know, and if an African country and someone Caucasian goes to that country, and that person's denied access to resources, then the black person can be racist because the black person is in control of the resources. So when I hear people talk about racism, they have gotten it really confused. Because it's not just excluding people. It's excluding people based on race, and you have the resources to do it. So that's, I always correct or give people the true definition of racism. So I think by talking about these things, even though they make people feel uncomfortable, even though people want to just put them under the rug and be Pollyanna about them, we are now moving slowly, inch by inch, in a positive direction. But we could have been much further along had we dealt with this pariah or social ill 100 years ago. But it was never addressed. And people who have been victimized, well, I don't like the word victimized, but people who have been treated in a disparate fashion by people based on race, you know, have halted the progress of this country. So this country could have been much further along, but I think people now are beginning to see how we can correct it. So having these discussions is not about blaming people or making disparaging remarks about people. It's not about hating anyone. And when people hate, that's the complete opposite of a healing. It's the two H's, but they have completely different energies. So in order to heal, like I had mentioned earlier in the show, you cannot heal cancer or anything else if you refuse to say that it's there. Because what will it do? It will eat you from the inside out. So what we have to do, what I see happening, it's not even a hope, but I see happening. I'm seeing people in this country having compassion, and they're looking at people and they're appreciating what they see in terms of phenotypic differences in terms of hair texture, skin color, ethnicity, because I think we need to embrace that. Some people cannot embrace that. In order for them to feel okay with someone, they have to make the person like them. I've heard people say, well, I don't really see her as being a black person. I don't really see him as being a white person. I'm like, well, in terms of the social categorizations, those are not accurate, but in terms of the skin type, you see someone with melanin in their skin and it's presenting itself. You see someone with less melanin in his or her skin and it's presenting itself. And to deny that reality is denying a part of who that person is. And sometimes people think that's being loving and kind, but it's the complete opposite. That's one of the most unfair things you can do to someone, to deny him or her his heritage, his phenotypic characterization. To say you don't see race is saying, well, I can't deal with you, because if I accept you as a person of African American ancestry, then my thoughts about you will kick in. That you are not on par with me, that there is a difference and there is a distinction between the two. So I don't want to feel like that. So I have to deny a major part of who you are. I have to then say I don't see race. And I said that is the most unkind, racist thing that a person can do, because race or the phenotype is there. You see someone with tightly curled hair or darker skin, and that's to embrace the person, not to deny that you don't see it. Because by embracing it, then you can see the beauty in the rainbow. You can see the beauty in the rainbow. And the rainbow has so many different colors. But if we only allow the yellow to come through and deny the green and the red and the other colors that are present in a rainbow, we'll be doing a disservice to the rainbow, because it's so beautiful and it's magnificent. When we look at the total rainbow, we can see that it's beautiful because of the mosaic, because of all the different distinctions and different colors. So to see people and to embrace what you see, to embrace the melanin in the skin, to embrace the tightly curled hair, to embrace the beautiful full lips, and to embrace the full nose, that then means that you're loving, you're honoring, and you're respecting people, because you can see them and the wholeness of who they are and love them, not in spite of, but because of that. That's the lesson on this planet. The metaphysical lesson, the Creator could have had all of us be, quote unquote, the same race. All of us look just like each other, like the Stepford wives and the Stepford husbands. But that wasn't what happened. So have you ever thought that the Creator wanted us to embrace the so-called differences and to love them and to honor them and to respect them? That's why they're there. Have you ever had that discussion within yourself? So when you're feeling uncomfortable about someone who looks different than you, and you wanted to put them in your world and have them defined as being an extension of you, just ask yourself, would you want that to happen to you if the shoe were on the other foot? Would you want someone to deny your essence and only accept you when you completely assimilated and gave up all of who you were in order to be in that friendship or relationship? Would that feel good for you? So if that would not feel good for you, how do you think it would feel for other people who are experiencing that, who are like Malcolm was when he was a young child and in school, and he was the smartest child in his school, but they couldn't accept that. The racism and the stereotyping in the teacher's head prevented him from seeing this young black child as someone who was very intelligent, and he was also African-American at the same time. So what he did is the teacher then twisted it and said, you know, you're black, so you can never become a lawyer. Why don't you be more practical and reasonable? Shooting for law school is almost an impossibility, because he could not embrace the fact that even though this child, because this child has melanin in his skin, he's equal to any other child in the classroom who does not have melanin as pronounced in his or her skin. So this is the challenge. The challenge is for us to hopefully step up to the plate, to start acknowledging when we're having these uncomfortable feelings come forth, to allow those feelings, and that's what I do with my Peace Be Still series, and hopefully you can go to YouTube and put in my name, Jamila, J-A-M-E-L-A, Franklin, F-R-A-N-K-L-I-N, or Professor Jamila Franklin, and my one video will come up, and it's my intention to have a video each week. But, so with the YouTube video, I go more into the Peace Be Still series. But as we learn to embrace each other and to highlight and welcome the differences and to be okay with that and to be truly loving and honoring and respecting people who are somewhat different than we, when we really, really get that and when we really totally embrace that, then true healing on this planet will be the outgrowth of that. And it will come. It will just be so, so powerful. It will come. But we have to, as Florence Gomeshian talks about it, step up to our Goliath, face our fears about racism, face our fears about giving up the stereotypes that we had about people based on our parents, face our fears about just whatever being completely true is all about, because a lot of times, or honest is all about, because sometimes people really don't want to follow the crowd, but they end up following them, following the crowd because they want to fit in. So dare to step outside of the crowd. Dare to be your own individual. Dare to think your own thoughts. Dare to act on your own thoughts. And then you will see this healing. It would just be so subtle, and then it would just be everywhere. It would permeate the entire environment, because you're doing your work. You're not ignoring those feelings that are being stirred up inside of you based on race. Either, you know, because you have been targeted and mistreated, you were no longer pushed that aside, because there are people who have experienced disparate treatment by people who did not look like them, and then they push it to the side and turn the other cheek. And those feelings don't go anywhere. They just come back with a vengeance. So now what I'm encouraging each of us to do is, on a day-to-day basis, and like I said, with my Peace Be Still series, I go more into it, on a day-to-day basis, to own all parts of us. If you're feeling that someone... If you're feeling uncomfortable with someone, or intimidated by someone, or afraid, just stop. Rather than projecting that onto the person, well, she made me feel like this, and because of what she said, I feel like this. Rather than projecting it on the other person, taking personal responsibility for your emotions, because they're only energy and emotion. Taking personal responsibility and asking the what question, not the why. What beautiful gift do you have to show me insecurity? Insecurity, why are you in my life? Or whatever it is, whatever the emotion is. And every time you're with someone who doesn't look like you, particularly someone who is African-American, if you are not African-American, and you feel that funny feeling coming up, ask yourself, what is being stirred up? Why am I feeling uncomfortable? Why am I feeling anger or fear? What is this about? And when you start asking those deep questions and start looking deeply within, those feelings would tell you why they're there. They would say, I'm here because you've believed in something about this person or people who look like this person, and you've been taught fear. Why would you taught fear? Sometimes we've been taught fear by society, because society has to have the haves and the have-nots. If everyone loved everyone and if everyone treated everyone fairly, then there wouldn't be any separation in terms of people being able to control you. So what you do is you use what's at your disposal, the the easiest thing to do to keep people polarized is to have them divide, the racial divide, along the lines of color. And then along the lines of wealth, but primarily color. And sometimes people in power have been very, very effective in doing this. They've been able to get people to divide and to be polarized and to hate based on race, which, like I said, is a sociological improper term anyway, but based on race, based on the phenotype, how people look. So now what we're going to do is take charge of our lives. You don't have to have people tell you how to think and how to feel about someone, because you can take charge of your life and you determine how you're going to think and feel about a situation or about a person. And when you take charge of your life, you start seeing your life change, not only in terms of your relationships with people who look different than you, but just within yourself. So this Black History Month, like I said, I would hope that people will use it as an opportunity to grow, to go to the next level, and to have open discussions about the things that have polarized this country for generations. And we can change that. Each individual has the power to change it, to heal yourself first. You can't heal someone else unless you heal yourself. So we can change it by having open discussions and by asking questions. And on both sides, the people who about whom you've had myths about, just coming from a place of genuine love and care and concern to have those myths addressed. So people who have perpetuated the myths and people who have been the target of the myths, I think, we're in a healing mode now. 2012 has come and gone, and 2013 had a lot of upheaval because people were dealing with the remnants of 2012. And because I see people making that turn and being willing to have the discussions, I'm feeling so very encouraged, because I know I don't only have hope. Hope is different than faith. I have faith that we're in a different energetic vibration. The things that used to work on this planet in terms of polarizing people and hating and all those things, they're still there, but most people are opting out of that and then moving on to a high vibration. So the people who are perpetuating the differences, the people who are perpetuating the hatred, the people who are perpetuating disparate treatment, they will pretty soon have a very small audience, if any audience at all, because people are moving away from that. But I think that in order to move away from it, we have to really own our own internal feelings. So then if you know that you're having feelings about someone just because the person looks different than you, or you fear the person, you've never had a negative experience with the person, but you fear the person because the person looks different than you, sounds different than you, speaks differently than you, just go inside and say, okay, where is this coming from? Where did I learn this? Because that's a learned reaction. Children normally don't have that kind of reaction. They learn it from the environment. So where did I learn this from? And is it serving me? And and it really isn't. Is it serving a purpose? No. Does it make me feel good? No. Well, why am I holding on to it? So those are the questions that can be raised, that can be brought to everyone's awareness, your awareness. And then you can then see people for who they are, because you're asking those questions and you're seeing, once you ask those questions, why am I afraid of John because he's African-American? Or why am I afraid of Bill because he's Caucasian? Or why am I afraid of Mary because she's Asian? Or why am I afraid of Linda because she's Latina? Or Sam because he's Native American? I bought the lie that different means less than. I bought that lie. And I see now that I'm having an open discussion with these people who phenotypically look differently than I. I'm seeing that we sound the same. We like the same foods. We play the same sports. We care for our children the same. I bought the lie. And once you start owning that, and you can only own it, as I've said throughout the program, you can only own it if you come to terms with it and you say to yourself, okay, I bought the lie. I saw some things on social media. I saw some programming on television. And like I've always said, television shows are called programming. It's not even real. So, and they're programming you to think a certain way, to be controlled. So once you see, like Florence Scovershin talks about the game of life and how it's played, then you can be in charge of the game as opposed to falling into default. The goal is for you to be in charge of your own life and to create it the way that you want it to be, not to be in default and having them pulling your strings, you know, like a puppet, because you don't know that they're behind the scenes controlling it. But once you get into alignment with your spiritual selves, your God energy, the energy of the Christ energy within, and I'm not talking about Christianity. Christ energy is like the heightened energy of your spiritual experience. Once you tap into that, then, and you stay centered in that energy, then you don't get caught up with all the isms, racism, sexism, ageism, classism, homophobiaism. It can no longer play an important role in your life because you've decided to see people as an extension of yourself, but that's because you've done your work. In my series, Peace Be Still series, will show you how to go in to do your inner work. Because to keep saying, I love everybody, and you really don't, to keep saying that race doesn't matter when you don't believe that, all we're doing is putting affirmations on top of unhealed stuff. And it'll work for a while, and I talk about that, like I said, in my series. But then the house of cards will come tumbling down. And I have so much respect for Iyanla because she talks about this. She said she had to heal her life. She had everything, the money, the business, the relationship, and everything, and it all came to a halt, and it all collapsed until she sat and decided to deal with her inner thoughts. So with this racism, it's been a cancer in the American psyche for so long. So I'm now saying that it's time. It is time for us to look at it, to look at this huge pink elephant in the middle of the floor that we're pretending it's not there. And people are walking around the elephant and tripping over the metaphoric elephant. Oh, I don't see an elephant with a tutu. Yeah, the elephant is there. So as long as we ignore the elephant, then we keep tripping on top of it and falling and whatever, because we don't want to acknowledge it, because we think that to acknowledge it means that they're, well, a lot of times people don't have the tools to acknowledge things that make them feel uncomfortable. So they deny that those things are there. And that's like one of the things, too, a lot of metaphysical leaders are telling people, just get over it. And I said, that's the worst advice, period. Worst, absolutely worst. Because those emotions have not gone anywhere. You've pushed them deeper into your psyche. And they become, they come out when you least expect it and cause us great discomfort in terms of panic attacks or some other things. Whatever you push down and don't address has to be expressed and come up to the light. So I thank you for joining us this evening, and we can have this discussion in our living rooms and the college rooms, public transportation, and talk about how much we have in common and honor the things that are different. And this so-called race is a thing that shows us physically that once we really deal with this issue, then we can love, honor, and respect everyone on the planet, because we know who we are, because we are owning all the parts of us to help us heal things like racism, sexism, homophobia, classism. And I have such great faith and knowing that we're on the right track. We're on the right track. And so thank you so very, very much. And read the people whose names I've provided with you this evening. Go and study them and read them. They're phenomenal scholars. And I thank you. I thank you. And until the next time, have a wonderful, wonderful week.
I release all disappointment from my mental, physical, spiritual, and emotional body. 'Cause I know that spirit guides me, and love lives inside me. That's why today I take life as it